Are you too many people? Take 4. 3, 2, and 1. Are you too many people? How often do we look at our beliefs and question them? Or what about our perceptions, which we use to form those beliefs? When I started college, I took a freshman course called Western Civilization. Dr. Feldman, the professor, was a balding, mustachioed curmudgeon with a permanent scowl. He used the Socratic method. The first day of class, he told us to leave the text at home. We wouldn't need it, although he did say, read it, because the school makes me test you on it. His questions made us question everything we thought we knew. One day, Dr. Feldman looked up from the attendance sheet and yelled, "Silcox!" I sheepishly raised my hand. "Why are the people starving in India?"
Too many people, not enough food," I replied.
Feldman got up on his chair and stood there shaking his hands, yelling, "Murderer! Murderer! Are you too many people, Silcox? Which number are you, the right number of people or the ones you call too many?"
"Gee, I didn't think."
"You didn't think. You didn't think. Let's see if we can do something about that before the end of the semester."
And then he went on to some other poor victim. I thought about it. Yeah, I did call millions of people too many. I could have just said not enough food or poor food distribution. I began to question my own thinking. I mean, I considered myself a caring soul. I gave to charities when I could. My parents taught me to be fair. And yet at 19 years old, without prompting, I wrote off millions of people as surplus. They had become abstractions, so remote and far away, they didn't even seem real. Then I thought, there are people in neighborhoods a few blocks from mine, and they also seemed remote. It's easy to devalue people when you don't really know them. In 1976, I left my first job in the corporate world to pursue a career in stand-up comedy. While I was struggling to make it, I took myriad jobs to pay the bills. One of them was promoting various brands of beer to restaurants and bars in North Philly, the urban core. The distributor who hired me paired me with Al, an African-American man who grew up in the neighborhood. We go from one establishment after another promoting everything from Maxima Super, the one beer to have when you don't have time for a case, as one consumer put it, and Old Frothing Schloss, among others. One day after visiting a few neighborhood bars, Al laughed and said, "Have you noticed how people look at us? They think we're cops." I said, "Why is that?" "Because we're a black guy and a white guy. That's what people think in the black neighborhoods." I had no idea. One afternoon, Al said, "Hey, why don't we go to my Uncle Bill's for lunch? He lives around the corner. He's always asking me to stop by." I said, "Do you think he'd mind us just dropping in?" Al assured me his uncle would welcome us with open arms, which he did. Uncle Bill was in his early 60s, but he appeared older and careworn. The wrinkles around his eyes bore the experience of a million heartaches. We sat at his kitchen table, and he prepared us a quick sandwich. He then sat down with us. We began discussing the upcoming presidential election. Jimmy Carter, the peanut farmer from Georgia, was the Democratic candidate. Uncle Bill shared an experience he had had in the Peach State. He served in Europe during World War II. His unit, the Red Ball Express, segregated by color from the other troops, drove and manned supply trucks to the front lines. They endured bombings and strafing and all kinds of carnage in their efforts to bring vital supplies to the frontline troops. And though they were treated different because of their color, they fought and served with just as much pride and passion as any other Americans. Bill came home to the States after the war. He returned first to Atlanta to hop a train to Philly. While waiting at the station, he had a powerful thirst. He was tired and worn out from all that he had been through, like millions of other soldiers. But when he went to get a drink, he saw a sign over the water fountain that said, "White." It was the only one nearby. He longed for a drink, but it wasn't permitted in segregated Georgia. He walked over to the fountain thinking he'd go for it anyway, but then he caught the forbidding stares from some of the white people on the platform. That was the only fountain available. He felt sick inside. "All I wanted was a drink of water," he said. "I just got back from serving my country, going through hell, and I felt proud of what I did, only to come home and be treated as a second-class citizen." He spoke slowly with a voice that betrayed the slightest quiver while his eyes moistened. "No, I can't vote for any man from Georgia. No, no, it's too much, too much." I pushed back my own tears as I thanked him for lunch and his service. I didn't know what to say. What do you say? The signs came down during the civil rights movement, but the racism behind them never really went away. What does it mean to fight for your country only to come home and be denied a simple drink of water because of your color? I saw what it means in Uncle Bill's eyes. None of us are too many. We're all human, and we share this little planet together.